Those of you who've been sitting in on some of the Bible studies this week know that I have been working very hard to take a number of events in the village and interpret them as affirmations for what I'm doing. When you get older, you need this kind of external help, like a rainbow I saw the other morning, and of course, and then a couple of people choosing the right kind of text that I was going to be talking about the next morning. And then last night, in the marvelous imaging of God, to lift up the God as lover for our, in preparation, obviously, for this session. I've been taking this all pretty personally, of course. Names are important, and this reminded me of something one of my favorite Lutherans, Christians, Martin Marty, did a long time ago, in fact, April of 1970, when he used a list of names of Lutheran churches. You maybe have heard this along the line, that are really names of Lutheran churches all over the country, and just listed them. And another friend of mine, Ron Burke, put these together, and Marty picked them up. And these were Lutheran church names like Peerless Lutheran Church. Of course, that's Peerless, Minnesota, but I thought that was a fair. Now, how about this one? Cold Water Lutheran Church? Sort of makes you shiver, huh? Another one, Dinky Lutheran Church? Had a real self-image problem with this parish. Or Swamp Lutheran Church in Plainsport, Pennsylvania. I don't know if these are all still existing or not. Another one sort of fit last night, Split Rock Lutheran Church. I don't know if that's what Susan had in mind about the rock. But and then Sinking Springs Lutheran Church. I thought that had a little taste to it. And then maybe the most honest one of all, Silent Lutheran Church. Allegedly in Madison, Wisconsin. But that all leads up only to these other names that I'm going to read for you. And these are all names of Lutheran churches. Eager Lutheran Church, Fertile Lutheran Church, Lear, LWR, Lutheran Church, Bang Lutheran Church, and Climax Lutheran Church. I suspect there's more going on than we know about. When I talk about intimacy, as I am wont to do, I suppose, I am always reminded of the quote from Thoreau, where he says, "I lose my respect for the person who can laugh at the subject of intimacy and sexuality. Yet when one speaks earnestly and seriously on the subject, is silent." So there's the gauntlet that I'm expecting you to participate during the discussion. And I want to stress how difficult it is to talk about this subject just because we are not very good at it and not very open to it. And I don't particularly like being read to, but I'm going to read a paragraph to you if you don't mind. It's where I stole the stuff I used in the announcement this morning. I can't find the source of this. I've photocopied it a long time ago. I'm looking yet for the source of this paragraph. "This world is no friend to grace. Seeking for intimacy at any level, with God or with persons, is not a venture that gets the support of many people. Intimacy is not good for business. It is inefficient. It lacks glamour. If love of God can be reduced to a ritualized hour of worship, if love of another can be reduced to an act of sexual intercourse, then routines are simple and the world can be run efficiently. But if we will not settle for the reduction of love to lust and of faith to ritual and run through the streets asking for more, we will most certainly disturb the peace and be told to behave ourselves and go back to the homes and churches where we belong. If we refuse to join the cult of exhibitionists who do a soul striptease on cue, or the quote-unquote flashers who expose their psychic nudity as a diversion for long-term covenantal intimacy, we are dismissed as hopeless Puritans. Intimacy is no easy achievement. There is pain, longing, disappointment, and hurt. But if the costs are considerable, the rewards are magnificent. For in relationship with another and with the God who loves us, we complete the humanity for which we were created. We stutter and stumble, wander and digress, delay and procrastinate, but we do learn to love, even as we are loved, steadily and eternally in Jesus Christ. So I'd like to lead us into some discussion about intimacy on the basis of the text that's in front of us in chapter 15 of St. John. We're going to be looking at verses 12 to 17. But I'd like to say a little bit about the context of this whole, small section from John that we're going to talk about. First of all, it comes from John. And right off the bat, we're into great imagery. In the beginning was the Word, whatever that conjures in our mind. And the Word is made flesh. And right away, we're in trouble. What does that mean? And we're working at it and struggling with it. And the imagery just flows through it and is exciting. And difficult, and one of the reasons most clergy say St. John is their favorite gospel because it's the one they gotta struggle with most of the time, and is marvelous too. The section we're in is at the time of the festival of the Passover, and so we come to Jesus as he is preparing his disciples, and I believe if you look closely, preparing himself for what's coming up in Jerusalem. And we find him, I think, in the upper room, talking to his disciples. I don't know if this is written anywhere else, but this section ought to be called, the intimacy of Jesus Christ with his disciples. Because you look at what he does in this section, beginning in chapter 13, he washes the disciples' feet. That's fairly intimacy. We had a foot washing right over there in 1962 here, and I remember how difficult it was. These were people who had gone on a two-day hike, and when they came back, we washed their feet. How many didn't want their feet washed? They didn't want their feet. It was too intimate. And, of course, dirty feet, as someone read the story beside it. And then he says, one of you will betray me. Have you ever thought how difficult it was for Jesus to say that? Are you comfortable saying one of your friends has betrayed you? You're going to tell your other friends about it? Very difficult, intimate revelation. And then he announces a new commandment. In fact, he repeats several times a new commandment. Almost saying, forget all the other stuff I said, remember this. Love one another, love one another, love one another, including the guy who went out. In my Father's house are many mansions. I have reservations for you. I'm going to take care. And Philip, I think he gets a bad rap for this. I think I and maybe all of us would have said to him, well, but Jesus, show us the Father. Just show us the Father. And Jesus is exasperated and says, Philip, have I been with you this long? And you're still saying, show us the Father. Father and I are one. And he spends time working at that. The intimate relationship with his Father. And then I will not let you orphaned. I'm not gonna abandon you. I'm not running away from my relationship with you. terrible close relationship. Peace I leave with you. Not as the world, but my peace I give to you. Anybody given you peace lately? Unsolicited by the pastor up front? Yeah, but it's intimate as all get out. And in the beginning of the chapter, I am the vine, you are the branches. You and I. And you will bear much fruit. And stresses how much God is counting on that fruit. And I leave you, I will be leaving you, I'm not going to be around, but I will not let you alone. The advocate will come. You're built-in marvelous babysitter, in the best sense of the word. I was raised by my Aunt Cal before they had babysitters. My mom liked to go downtown in Chicago, and so we often ended up at Cal's house. Probably spoiled the daylights out of me. My first wife knew she spoiled the daylights out of me. But she was an advocate. She was, in some real senses, the Holy Spirit for us. And then comes our text, and then the garden, and then the betrayal, and then the trial, and then the death, and then the resurrection. Intimacy, right in the midst. So let's look at that text. Would someone be willing to read it from John chapter 15, 12 to 17? Just those verses, please.
This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that one lay down life for their friends. You are my friends if you do what I command. No longer do I call you servants, for the servant does not know what the master is doing. But I have called you friends, for all that I have heard from my Father I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit, and that your fruit should abide, so that whatever you ask the Father in my name, he may give it to you. This I command you, to love one another.
I think the one place in the scriptures where we are called friends, there are other close implications for similar feelings, similar ideas, and no longer servants, but friends. And it's important just for the word, because we seem so distant from God, because so much up there and we're so much down here. We are, body and soul are a given, but we're preoccupied with our body in parts thereof and systems thereof, what this text is, I think, pushes us to do is to see and talk about and feel and believe and live the vertical dimension of all relationships that we so often lose or miss or don't see. And it starts, at least so I believe, with the relationship to God. I think I could go on both sides and say it starts with our relationships and then we learn about God's, back and forth. But anyway, at the moment we'll talk about our relationship to God. It's not only that he called, Jesus says, you are my friends, but the reasons that he says it. For a servant doesn't know what the master is doing on the outside. But I call you friends because I have given you all that I have received from the Father. The working definition of intimacy is giving totally of yourself, totally in quotes because we're humans, but giving of yourself to another, and equally so, receiving of a self from another. popularly, I think a lot of people say, we don't have a lot of friends because we're afraid to let ourselves go and to be open to another. Not that there's a great deal of truth in that, I think. I almost think it's more difficult for us to have friends because of our unwillingness to receive another. Bag and baggage. Warts and all. Accomplishments and all. Gifts and all. Because once a person has given herself or himself to us, we carry that. We carry that person. I don't mean lift them up, but we have all of that. We know all of that. And a lot of us, that's a heavy burden. To know somebody so much better than we are, or somebody so much worse than we are. It's not easy, kind of a thing. So intimacy has difficulty of, because we are often afraid to reveal ourselves, or maybe we don't know, that we are afraid not to know each other. I was in therapy for, oh my goodness, 4 or 5 months before I could identify a feeling. I hate to say that. You have, what, 4 million of them per minute or something like that? And it took me that long in therapy. I don't know a thing about myself. I know very little, knew very little. I know some now. And so I'd like to say some things about intimacy and maybe a couple of quotes and stuff, and then ask you to respond about your feeling and your understanding and your willingness to talk about your intimacy with God and God's intimacy with us, as well as to one another. I buy into an article I read again this morning, by George Mylander. I don't know if he is Lutheran. Well, I think he has some Lutheran background, but he's teaching at some, I was going to say highfalutin, but that's not nice. A very prestigious, that's highfalutin. Seminary. Right. George was one of the first people to be writing about friendship and theology. Some maybe 30 years ago, one of the first. And now he's wondering about that. He's wondering if we aren't making friendship a way out, and that we are using friendship to find somebody who is so like us that we don't need all these other people around us. And so we go into friendship to be affirmed only, you and me, kid, we'll face the world. when we delete the vertical dimension. And his point is that may be one of the problems in friendships, that we don't see it for having its vertical dimension, or we don't acknowledge or work at or let that vertical dimension be important to us, or obviously even talk about it. Let me say what some of the ingredients I think are of, and again, these are some echoes from last night. You might catch up, but I can tell you when this was written, so I'm not stealing from last night at the moment. I think some of the ingredients of intimacy are mutuality, which I don't think we've been very good at all. In a competitive, individualistic type of a world. You know, we grow up this way. We're being carried around in somebody and then outside of somebody. And then we have teachers and firemen and policemen and everybody and all this kind of stuff. And eventually, sometime we get to where there might be something on either side. So captivated by something. You know, the world wants us to believe that it's looks and externals and all the other stuff, but more than that, that we're never locked in mutually, so we are mutually everything. But in some cases, this part of the mutualities a little more, and we catch up or want to, or we stay where we are. But there are things that come together this way. I think that's been one of maybe the most significant difficulties in being intimate, is to really, really want something, not to take away from another person, but something of the other person. Just as when God describes it, we're intimate, we're God's friends, because he has given all to us. And another ingredient is trust. I don't think Phyllis has heard me say this. When I trust my wife, and because she is, thank God, fully human, and so am I, that means it takes work to trust. In advance of what my spouse says, even if I don't like what she says, and even if I don't understand what she says, I believe that what she says is for my well-being and for our well-being. In advance. That's tough. Trust is very difficult. Very difficult. But I think it's one of the ingredients. Openness is another. Honesty. Not, you know, it's got to be all out now, and if you know, the psychic nudity or whatever was said, a lot of people are more willing to get nude with somebody else to reveal themselves, and openness calls for being willing, again, as I said a moment ago, not only to be seen for who you are and with your limits and failures, but also to see another person as he or she is, with failures and limits. Another dimension of intimacy for me is risk, to reach out and try, to reach out and explore, to be willing to go a little further. Jesus talked a lot about more. There was more to life, this, and this. And I think we often settle for less, and we're encouraged to have risk more with one another. And it's always a risk, a relationship. God was risking like man. Well, in love, I'll risk my son. Ooh, ooh, tough. And we risk with one another. The daily risk of knowing how much to give to yourself. If I give all of myself to Phyllis, what's left? She's cheated. If she gives all of herself to me, there's nothing over there. So without even thinking about it, all day long, we're giving of each other. How much? Here, here. Making decisions all the time. Or risking to lose one another. Or risking to let another go? No human possesses another human. Not bad for parenting, by the way, but also in our relationships of intimacy. And the ultimate, it seems to me, is being willing even to let one go. Don't push me on that one. That's tough. But I think it is part. And then finally, another ingredient is gentleness. Gentleness. And I've been saying this for a terrible long time, but I'm compelled to still say it. Women are so much better at expressing gentleness than men. So much better. Not that I believe men are incapable of gentleness. There are gentle men. But women are so far. Gift of God, gift of experience, whatever, whatever. know whether it comes from hormones or Prozac, what, I don't know. But it's there. And that's a heavy burden for women, because I think they're called to teach us men to be gentle. Ooh, I know a lot of women that don't want to do that, and I don't blame them. And equally, that's heavy for men, because men have to be willing to learn from women what it means to be gentle. Now, those are gross statements, wide statements. Surely we learn lots from one another in all different ways. I think it's still true that gentleness is so far best expressed in women. I think we're improving. There's some. I think I'm improving. There's some. That's my definition of love and intimacy. And because I think that's how God loves us, that God chooses to be mutual with us and comes to be one with us, incarnate in the flesh, not only to go to the cross, but to be friends with us and to be tempted in every way, even as we are. And that God trusts us in advance, knowing how we can screw up and mess up and whatever it is, and takes those crazy Israelites back again and again and again, and those crazy Holdenites back again and again. The scruffy Israelites and the scrubby disciples, if you're going to read Mark, and says, okay, it's in your hands, take it. That's trust. Openness, as I said before, that God gives all, holds nothing back, reveals self and accepts our vulnerability as well. And that God risks the hurt and pain of a relationship with us, not surprised at being hurt, at our failures, or being surprised that we won't get cocky about our successes and our loves, and that God is gentle with us. As blessed Martin Luther knew so well, everybody was scared of God then, I suppose in some ways we are now. So he says, look at the babe sucking on the nipples of his mother's breast. There's your God. Anything more beautiful, more gentle than that? Don't be scared. The gentleness of God. So that's what I think intimacy is about and what we ought to be looking for. Keeping the vertical dimension in all of our relationships, which is not easy to do. Somebody asked earlier this morning, well, what if the other person doesn't have that vertical direction? Well, we're mutual all different ways and still committed to one another. Someone else said, for instance, when a child dies, the husband and the wife, the father and the mother, grieve at different paces, different levels. And if you're committed to the goal of finally overcoming the grief and living within the grief, it might take different times, but you're still mutual. One is maybe here, one is there, whatever it may be. And we are mutual in all kinds of different ways. And I think us to be aware of the of a vertical dimension in a relationship without requiring the other person to be at the same place, or maybe even understanding it at all. When Paul gets on his little theological high horse and says, oh, be careful of these relationships, Paul was worried about losing the vertical dimensionship, or dimension, I think. That's what I believe Paul was about, and that's what his warning is. And sure, why lose the gift you've got, intimacy with God? And somebody else said this morning, too, and I like these comments, including him, and that's why we have to be careful of wanting to have too many intimate relationships, because they're tough. And they take time, and they are energy absorbing. You know, we can't. Probably one of the strongest arguments for monogamy is the fact that we can't handle it. We can't handle it. True intimacy. There may well be other reasons for that too, but true intimacy. And therefore, we do have a few friends. I think it's Eric Byrne that the book from way back lists all those level, quote, unquote, levels of friendship, of relationships, moving up to friendship and intimacy. But that we relate to people in all different ways. You can see the vertical dimension in a person you say hi to at work, as well as to your lover. I'm working on a book on keeping body and soul together, so I got lots of stuff to share, but I'm going to stop here and let you do some sharing and reaction to what we're doing. But first, let me push you back to the text again. I've taken you away. Let me push you back. Again, my question is, where's the gospel in this text? And this is John 15:12-17. Where's the gospel? Good old question.
The gospel is in what Christ said there, which is the new commandment I give to you. Because the old commandment is love your neighbor as yourself. He said, love them as the other neighbor as I have loved you. And that's an entirely different love. There's lots of things I love myself. Things I did wrong, I didn't like it. But to love someone as Christ loved them, made that relationship entirely different. Right. And as Christ's relationship was entirely different to us, right, mine can be different.
That God, that Christ said that, and that is important, I have no doubt. But when you talk about Christ telling us to do something, I don't use the word gospel for that. Right. Absolutely true what Christ said. But now when I say gospel, I want to know, what is the good news in this? That's good news that we can do that. But see, you get back to my definition, at least that I'm trying to work with this week, of gospel being what God has done for us so that we can do that. Because by ourselves, we couldn't do that, even if he said it, without something else. How does that part come through? That gospel come through?
Yeah. The gospel that I hear there is that I don't need to choose Christ. He chose me.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah. There's more.
Pardon? I call your friend.
Right. I do the calling. And you did not choose me.
I have loved you. How about I have loved you as a gospel?
Pardon?
I have loved you.
Right. That certainly is good.
Others as I have loved you.
All right. I have loved you is certainly.
How much?
Sure.
Totally, completely.
Mm-hmm.
Give up your life.
Sure. Yeah, that's the other line too. The greater love is this, to lay down one's life for one's friend. And that's what Jesus Christ did, we believe, for us. So there's loaded gospel in this section to energize us to be able to do what he calls us to do, as he keeps coming back. Love one another, as he says that. But the preface for all of that is, I have loved you, I have died for you, I call you my friend, I choose you, I want you, and that's back to that trust business, no matter what.
Well, the fact that he's chosen us, like you said, knowing full well who we are.
there's no condition
right.
there.
Right.
And, you know, in order not to make it cheap grace, we always add to that, as a result of it, sure we fall. Sure we want to walk that path. We are on a journey, we do that. But it starts with that origin of I don't know what other words to use, crazy, weird, whatever it is that God, in spite of knowing our human way, we'd say, no good for this. Or let's have plan B, or C, or whatever it is. And God says, no, here it is. Tosses it in the laps of nudniks in the Old Testament and in the New, in the First Covenant and in the Second. Yes?
Yeah, also, the Gospel also says, you can talk about intimacy, I've revealed myself to you.
Mm-hmm.
I have not held back.
Yeah.
I washed your feet here, but the price, you know, I've told you everything that I know about God.
Mm-hmm.
And I've demonstrated my life is given to you. So,
yeah.
And the revelation is, I guess, the word that sure. speaks to me, that it's not hidden or mysterious mm-hmm. for these people, it's been made visible.
Sure.
And that's. Now, I guess I have a hard time getting that today. I mean, they were there. It's kind of like what Philip says, you know, just show us the Father.
Yeah, yeah, come on. Yeah. Oh, I long for, every once in a while, I long for, give me a good piece of revelation. Something like sink my teeth in and share and go on. And then a service like last night, the imaging of God. That was a piece of revelation for me. I was so caught up in what we were doing last night, I confess. And it was like showing me the Father. And I was grateful for that last night. And that's what Holden is, of course, for me too. Why I keep coming back even when they don't invite me. I'll be back in September. Somebody else.
Well, maybe I would think of somebody. I don't think any of us are having trouble with the fact that God has
mm-hmm.
become so intimate with us and Jesus Christ, certainly. And he was perfect. I think where I'm coming from is that then myself to go out and be intimate with how many ever I can energy will allow or find.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that I can't. I would get frustrated if I could give that same kind of friendship that Jesus does because he's so perfect.
Mm-hmm.
That I struggle. I feel sometimes guilty because of this perfect or intimate friendship I have with
yeah.
someone,
yeah.
and lo and behold, I forgot them on something or
yeah.
did something.
Yeah.
So I don't know
yeah.
where we come with that as humans and intimacy where we fail even
yeah.
when we want to be
sure.
intimate. Something like
yep,
that.
Failure.
Maybe
is...
nobody has that feeling.
Oh no. I think you spoke for all of us. At least you spoke for me too. Yeah, failure is part of our life. You know, I said this earlier in the week, is the lovely Jewish psychiatrist I had, you keep preaching that perfectionism stuff, I'm going to be in business for a long time. For sure. And it can't be perfect. We acknowledge our own humanity, therefore limits, whatever those may be. And as I think I'm going to say in Vespers tonight, our ability to deceive ourselves. One of the definitions of sin is self-deception. And it's working away from that because even this person so good at self-deception, God says, I give you the whole bit. And that's why we need the gospel being reminded again and again so we don't plummet. In failure and not being able to be perfect. Yeah. I I believe the church has let us down in this area, and not viciously or anything like that. It's clear to me that most people know what the church is against in terms of intimacy. Don't talk too far, don't mess around with it, and don't all this kind of stuff. But the church hasn't been as helpful, in my opinion, in helping us see what the church is for in being an intimate person and being a sexual being. We've been wary of that. And the excuse I give, you gotta have a lot of excuses, is that we were trained by somebody who was trained by somebody who was trained by somebody who came out of the pietistic movement of Europe, and wherever that came from, somebody else can tell me. And then, and there's been little interruption. I think Mary Calderon, I don't even know if she's still living, who taught us about the word sexuality. That came in the 40s, late 40s. We had just talked sex before that. Sexuality began to be a custom word from ASEC, the Association of Sex Educators, that Mary Calderon headed. Proud to have been on some programs with Mary. And she was a little bit of an intersection with interrupting the frozen way we talked about this. We did. You weren't a particular sexual being until you had the sex act. And that's what the focus is still on. When I wrote a book, of all things, for the Missouri Synod, I'm proud of them for that, on sexuality. And the team that got together, there were two of us, that didn't think it should just be an organ recital. We were really talking about people called to be sexual beings, and that children are sexual beings, and that this is a sexual relationship right now, and that all that I am as man and human is being used to communicate with you, and in all of your listening as male or female is being used to come back and forth. These are sexual relationships. Now you go wacky if you start talking about everything being sexual or intimate. But there is a great need. I think people are, I may be deluded and self-deceived on this too, that are longing for something better in understanding themselves as sexual beings and giving themselves as sexual beings with the vertical dimension as part of it. Somebody else? Sure.
I like the word nurturing in relationship. Mm-hmm. The word nurturing.
Yes. Want to say why? Want to add to it?
Well, that's because you are giving to the other person the right to grow, mm-hmm. and to be the best person that he can be or she can be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a vertical, the vertical,
mm-hmm.
if you're doing that.
Mm-hmm. You are being nurtured also as
yes.
well as...
Yes, and that's a wonderful thing if you can get to that.
Sure.
Rather than to always be this
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
about ideas and things.
Sure.
Or needing to be just a little better in your thoughts than your partner.
The competition.
That you have sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good to acknowledge to the other person that this is really good,
mm-hmm.
that what they're doing is good, or go ahead with it.
Mm-hmm.
Try it, even if you're scared.
Yeah.
Would the word be right, or would it be help? You see, you give them the right to be, but also you give them, if you're nurturing, say you're helping them to
sure.
be gentle, a better person, not just the right. You're both.
Both.
Sure.
Both.
Sure.
The help comes in there.
Other enriching.
I like your thought of saying that you don't own anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We don't own our children.
Mm-hmm.
We are given them as a
mm-hmm.
gift
mm-hmm.
to nurture.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And to become the best mm-hmm. that they can so that they can go out on their own.
Good.
And do the same with their nurturing.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
People.
And always with a vertical dimension of that great gift that God has given.
You might sometimes end up this way. But for the most part, it should be this way.
Well, yeah, vertical, if you know, from God to us, that's what I mean by the vertical dimension. We can be closer this way, but it's coming to us that enables us to be at some times, you know, in a helping position. There's nothing wrong with carrying somebody. If you've broken a leg, you want somebody to carry you. You know, I enjoy bad health because people take care of me. Well, I've always said that about some of us clergy. We always like to help people, you know. And that's why those pulpits were up high. Well, they were to be able to see, too, so we could look down on the people. Or we're very good at hospital calls. We're standing, they're lying. You know? And somebody said in the last session, a lot of teachers are doing the same thing, you know, standing up front or even standing in the back, whatever it may be. But the move towards some kind of exchange that doesn't ignore the gifts we may have, which may be far more in a certain area. You may know far more about Shakespeare or about God or whatever it may be. And you can give that, but it doesn't have to be, you know, towering over or conflicting.
I'm struck when you use the word nurturing. I have often thought of the Eucharist as umbilical. Hmm. And when it's those times when I am offering communion that I'm most aware of my sexuality as a pastor, in that I feel like I am umbilically attached to God, and I am umbilically attached to those to whom I am distributing the elements, and that has nothing to do with better than, you know, it has totally to do with gift. You know, it happens to be the way things are. I was umbilically attached to my son, not because I'm better, just because that's how I'm made, you know. And so when I think about that nurturing element, I came back to the Eucharist and thought about the ways that nurtures on so many levels. Sure.
I've talked earlier this week in a number of places about St. Leo's Parish, Catholic Parish in Tacoma. And they baptize in the tub. And again, I think there's some very nurturing things there that you wash the child, you know. The baby goes down and nude goes into the water. And loads of the adults choose to put on the robe and go under the water. And so there's a nourishing, a nurturing kind of a dimension of that for those who do the rite for them.
There is, however, a downside to those kinds of images, and I don't mean to say that I don't appreciate the nurturing images and so forth, but especially folks who work in family systems have discovered that there is a false kind of nurturing and a false kind of intimacy that they have labeled enmeshment. I just call it blobby, gooey kind of stuff, where one person gets really lost inside another person or another group of people and loses their identity completely. You can always tell those people because, if, for example, you come up to a husband in a family who is enmeshed in that family, and you say, "Well, how are you doing, Joe?" And he says, "Oh, we're fine. As a matter of fact, Sue and the kids."
Yeah.
You know, and the person cannot identify themselves anymore. And I think we have to recognize that detachment is not the opposite of enmeshment, but they are two poles on a continuum, the middle of which would be the ability to be yourself and to touch others, as folks like Pete Steinke and maybe Rabbi Friedman would define it. And it's at that point that intimacy can happen, not at the enmeshed side of things, where a person will disappear altogether. And too often in congregations, in families, in businesses, in communities, even like Holden, it is that enmeshment that is enshrined as intimacy, rather than understanding it as the destructive and person-destroying thing that it really is.
Sure. Any good gift, including brains and memory, can be used to abuse anybody else. The first value I would lay out in a theology of sexuality and intimacy is self-liberating. You have to be a self to do it, and I think God liberates us in Jesus Christ. So we can be who we are individually with another person, and also in the community of faith as well. Surely agree with that. And again, that's where the self-deception is. We can use the word nurturing and smother. You know, and there are lots of this thing of children coming back home again. I got all kinds of questions about that. Whose need to come back home? I always look. I don't mean I can understand it, but I always look. Often as, oh my gosh, finally they're coming home again. Oh, 3 or 4 days ain't bad. And that's the same limit I put on my visits to my kids, too. 3 or 4 days may not be bad. But it can, we can deceive ourselves readily into wanting to believe what we want. It may be helpful, it may not. But and we can be nourishing from afar as well. Someone else. Oh, I wanted to say something too about that. Just let me slip this in and then ask you. I don't know where it came with the nursing thing, but I can't make the connection now. That our definition of fidelity has often been the absence of adultery. Which is really pretty dumb. Oh, yeah, they're really faithful. Neither of them have been to bed with anybody else. Oh, no. Yeah. The man in bed with his wife who has never committed adultery, who doesn't care about her emotional and the intellectual and physical and whatever well-being, is unfaithful. That's not fidelity. Fidelity is the commitment that all that I have is given so that the well-being and good choices and whatever else of the other is there. And again, not perfect, no way. But where we're going and what we're working at and why we ought to have communities of faith. Here I think I shall stick out my neck. Now I get in trouble with Walt Bowman. I heard Tink say that they are not Trinitarian. They are tetrarchic. Is that the right word? Tetrarchic. I'm going to propose we get to be tetrarchic, not lose the Trinity. Let's bring them right along as they are bringing us along. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and community. And community of faith. That as soon as we are attached to the Trinitarian God, we are part of a community that enables us so much to talk to one another. The pastor oughtn't be the only good one to help us grieve. There's a whole bunch of people in our community that can do it, you know, that they would not want, that the community isn't perfect, but that it could help us. I find very few people turning to the church for a sense of community. You know where my son gets it? Fire department. They depend on one another. No, it's not the same, of course. I'm not talking about Christian community. I mean, he gets another sense of community. And I'm not wanting to go tetrarchic and all that, but I'm wanting to pick up what we say so well about the community of faith, but so rarely experience. And again, one of the attractions of Holden, or living here long term, is dealing with the toughness of being community. I think back in the 60s, I made a file folder that said, living in Christian community, ?? And it's still on my desk with the question mark. Because it's so tough. I don't pretend to, there are no easy outs. But I'm pushing us a little bit that maybe quasi-tetrarchic that dry creek would help us. But there were a couple of hands.
I don't understand what you mean by tetrarchy.
Four rather than three. Trinitarian tetrarchy. Three, four. Community, I was saying.
Community.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Right. Susie, I didn't make it clear. Good. Right.
Actually, two comments. I had an earlier one, and I'll get back to the earlier one first.
Please.
Since you mentioned the Trinity. One of the most interesting books I read on the Trinity not so long ago was a revelation for me because it talked about the Trinity and community. The Trinity as community. They had even a fancy Greek word for it, Epicurus. That's unimportant, but the important thing is the community in the Trinity, and then
wow.
That connected it up to the kingdom of God as the model for our community.
What, got the title?
Yeah,
book?
It's Jürgen Moltmann,
his
book on the Trinity.
Okay.
The kingdom of God.
Thank you.
And the way in which we've learned to begin to experience this in our parish is in small group work, it has been transformative for us and for those persons who are committed to small group. And it is one concrete way to share with us.
Right.
Where we said we're small enough to care and large enough in the public service to celebrate. But my second question, this was just an observation.
Sure.
My second question was, you have so much fun here in being intimate with us. I wonder if you would comment a little bit about the dimension of playfulness as an important ingredient of intimacy.
Sure, yeah. I start off with self-liberating. Another one of the values that I would lay out is joyous. And the play, and the fun with each other, and sensuality, and I brought along, and I haven't even opened them. Ask Phyllis to remind me. I brought along, I think, 7 books on humor and hilarity that I think ought to be in the library. They'd probably never be used. They're all pretty serious about humor. But the place where, a place that is known for its hilarity, one of the only place I know in the church where hilarity or humor is found in its mission statement, you know, and it is here, that we ought to have those books are. And pleasure. Pleasure in intimate relationships. The joy that God has in us and the joy that we have in one another. There was a hand back there too, I think, or here, where? We're running out of time, but I'll...
Well,
please, yeah.
Just a comment about self-liberating and Christian community.
Yeah.
I think that the Christian community has really severely limited our concept of self-limiting. It takes you to, you're about 40, to recognize that self-liberating is a good thing.
Oh, yes.
And then we have all these 40 years of not knowing how to be intimate. So you're working backwards.
Right.
And I think that if the church, if we could instill in our children the idea of being a godly kind of self-pleasing person, we would learn to be intimate much earlier.
I think so too. I love working with adults in the church because I'm counting on them to help us bring out some self-liberated children in the world down the line. The goal is to get it started earlier. But I do think, I think the church has been so captivated by children, educated children, and still send them home to, quote, dumb adults, who don't understand what that's about. I want to push us to work with adults who will liberate children, who will bring up children who will, whatever. But you're right. That's terribly important and terrible wasteful. There's a line there somewhere about this, a sin to waste of something. I don't know what that is. Somebody,
one little statement I heard along
sure.
that line. The main job of a parent is to teach children to leave home.
Okay. So, yes.
Yeah, maybe community is so hard in the church because we don't have like people. We have a mix.
Mm-hmm.
We have such a tremendous mix.
Mm-hmm.
We really have to work in community because they aren't people who like us necessarily. And we may not necessarily like each other in terms of when you work with someone or, you know, you've got a common goal.
Yeah.
But in the church, you're very, very, very different people coming together.
Sure.
And that's tough.
I think that is. Did I miss a hand somewhere over here, too? Oh, if not, time's up. Thank you very much.
Okay.